Blog Talk Radio.
Washington, D.C. It's Tuesday, 4 o'clock here on the East Coast, 1 o'clock on the West Coast, and globally, it's Greenwich Mean Time, and I don't keep track of that. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital.
The place to be.
It is the place to be, Bob, and this is Backroom Politics, which broadcasts to you live on Blog Talk Radio every Tuesday from 4 to 6. And I got to tell you, there is a lot of stuff going on here in Washington, a lot of stuff going on globally. But first, as we do every Tuesday, it's time to introduce our weekly roundtable of political experts, pundits, and those addressing issues of domestic and international affairs. First up is, he is the former vice president of the National Broadcasting Corporation for Government Affairs. He's a former board member of the National Association of Broadcasters, former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
He is a bar certified attorney in the great state of New York and the District of Columbia. He is the vice president of the Eurasia Center here in Washington, D.C. He is our international affairs expert. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. Glad to be here. And I must say, Ni Shirpong, in a way, Ni De Hun Cheng Gong.
I still don't get it. Still, one of these days, we've got to Google Translate that. And I'm your moderator and host, Justin.
I'm almost afraid to ask.
I don't want to know. I will tell you right now.
Because you're very successful.
Well, that's very kind of you. You're a fortune cookie. Thank you. I'm your moderator and host, Justin Russell. And for the next 2 hours, we're going to be talking about all things political, all things international, anything that affects everything inside the Beltway, outside the Beltway, and into your homes and communities. A lot of stuff going on here in Washington. What has been kind of the focal point of what's been going on in Washington continues to be the situation in the Middle East, and in particular in Libya. Last night, the president gave a speech. He addressed the nation regarding our actions militarily here in Washington, D.C. He spoke over at the National Defense University right by the Potomac River. Beautiful, beautiful venue. An appropriate venue, I think, for the president. But there's still a lot of criticism coming out about the subject of our involvement in Libya, how much we're involved in the Libyan conflict. And ultimately, there's now questions coming about his ability to truly lead America through this time of conflict. Ralph, I don't know, did you see the president's speech last night?
I saw some of it. I think one of the issues, if you take the position that we should have gone in based on for humanitarian reasons, you also should feel it's important that in order to help the humanitarian crisis and end the carnage, the focal point has to be the elimination of Muammar Gaddafi. He has to get him to step down, or you have to take him out. Leaving him in there is going to continue to cause a lot of carnage and chaos and misery for the Libyan people.
Well, you know, it's funny. Prior to the broadcast, Bob, you and I were talking about that specific situation. One of the things that I noticed that the president did not do, and I'll be honest, I thought, you know, President Obama looked very presidential. He looked very much and sounded very much, taking away the message, he sounded and looked very president. He looked like a solid commander-in-chief. But there was a problem. What did you view as the problem in his speech yesterday?
Well, my concern from the get-go has been what is the end game? I mean, the president has said we are not trying to kill Gaddafi. Okay, I take him at his word. But the fact of the matter is, if Gaddafi remains there after the West, the military effort of the NATO forces go home, what has happened? I think maybe we haven't advanced anything, any matter of rights, and we probably have caused the Libyan people to have a real big problem with on their hands. I'm not so sure that, you know, the problem, Justin and Ralph, is that, you know, there are so many places, as we were talking earlier before we came on the air, there's so many places in the world that have, you know, failed countries, bad governments, you know, despots who take all the value out of the country, put it in the Swiss bank, and eventually figure they'll go there and go retire. And it's, I mean, Gaddafi is one of those kind of people. Now, but there are a lot of those kind of people. I mean, what's the reason that we went in here specifically to, in effect, as the president says, it's to protect, you know, from a humanitarian situation, the fact that he was prepared to, you know, basically attack Benghazi with all his forces and just, you know, kill maybe tens of thousands of people. That's a terrible thing, but there's an awful lot of places around the world where people are getting killed by their government for speaking up.
And the ironic thing is that up to this point in time, Gaddafi did not pose a threat to the United States.
Not to the United States, no. I mean, we worked out a deal with him after President Reagan, you know, took him on
to give up the nuclear program.
He gave up the nuclear program.
And he paid the survivors.
Right. The survivors. Right. And he's basically... he hasn't been running amok internationally.
Well, and before we go any further, I want to give out, for those of you who are listening and you'd like to call, chime in, give us your questions, your thoughts, any topic is open forum for our roundtable. We invite you to call in. The number is 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. We invite you to call in and ask our roundtable any questions or give us your thoughts and comments, and we'll address them on the air. Going back to the question in Libya, we have a very distinct situation right now where the message, I'll be honest, the message that, or lack of message that President Obama had last night, going back to your point, Bob, is we still have no definitive end game. Which is surprising. I mean, anybody who is even watching TV knows what the end game is. Gaddafi has to go. He can no longer remain in power. Yet, we find the president somehow tap dancing around this whole issue. How is that? Why is that? And why is there a lack of message?
Well, I think the problem is, under this UN mandate, it's not about regime change or about getting rid of Gaddafi. It's averting a, quote, humanitarian disaster. However, that begs the question, in order to avert this humanitarian disaster, you've got to get rid of the cause, and that's Muammar Gaddafi. Now, the problem now is there's heavy fighting in Misrata, and the march to Tripoli has been halted, which means the rebels are going to need assistance on the ground. Does that mean NATO is going to commit to ground forces? And will the U.S. commit troops? Will other countries? Obama has said no.
Bob, I mean, what do you think? What are you thinking on this?
Well, I think that Ralph's right. I mean, the end game has to be something that we're not talking about. Gaddafi, one way or another, you know, leaving control of Tripoli, whether he goes out in a box or goes out into a lovely retirement someplace with all his Russian nurses. But the fact of the matter is, the reality is, the program is that's the goal. Everybody does not speak.
Right.
Well, here's the situation. You know, when we see the president and everybody's been asking for, especially on the talking head shows this morning, everybody's been asking the question, why won't President Obama say what everybody's thinking and express the intent of this operation is to get Muammar Gaddafi out of power. There are presidents that have been seated before Obama that would have said that automatically. Yet we have a problem with President Obama saying that now. And that's the one thing that our country wants to hear.
Well, Ralph said it right. I mean, the UN mandate is not to go after Gaddafi. It's to protect the citizens from the Gaddafi government. Now, given that fact, we're not about to go and deliberately appear to be enlarging the mandate, which we do not have. So from that standpoint, I think the president is absolutely correct not to say we're going to see Gaddafi out one way or another, because once he does that, he's gone beyond the mandate of the Security Council. He's gone beyond the desires of the probably of the Arab League. I just don't think it would be very bad for him politically, internationally, to make that statement, whether he intends to do it or not.
But at some point, there's going to have to be an acknowledgement that Gaddafi is the core problem and he's got to go.
But
now, who makes that? Is that Obama? Is that the UN?
You
know,
you
that's the question.
You cannot tell me right here, right now, that the Arab League, in their consent decree, and the UN, in the UN resolution authorizing a no-fly zone, you cannot tell me that any of the voting members of both those organizations that voted in favor of it have the understanding, or they are lacking the understanding that the end game is one end game. I don't care internationally. The Arab League knows Gaddafi got to go. Even the more liberal members of the Arab League, i.e. Jordan, i.e. Bahrain, and even Bahrain is marginal. But you look at those, they all acknowledge the fact that he is a problem. He could be a thorn in the side of progress in the Gulf states and in the Middle East as a total. Why not just come out and say it?
But this is what Gaddafi's done. It's been very smart. He has offered oil contracts to China, to Russia, to other countries to come on board and support his regime, whether it's in the UN or a willingness to ask for a ceasefire, which the Russians did, or to just remain neutral. So this is the kind of power this guy has.
Bob?
And remember this. The Arab League was very reluctant to have a no-fly zone. How much more reluctant can a group of relatively conservative governments, how much more can they be upset about outsiders, non-Muslims, non-Arabs, coming from the UN, obviously, and with their agreement, how much do you think more they would be concerned? Not about, it's one thing to say we don't want to have a humanitarian disaster. It's something else to say we're going to go get the son of a bitch, and that's the reality of it.
And they're also aware that Gaddafi can use oil money to finance radical Islamic fundamentalist groups that want to topple these regimes in the Gulf.
But now we have a situation where the question comes up, did we poke the sleeping bear in the Middle East by providing the air support coverage, or are we in fact trying to affect change in what could be a progressive and stable country in Libya?
Well, we didn't provoke the bear, the sleeping bear. The sleeping bear was wide awake and growling like hell and just about to pounce on, whatever he was going to pounce on. He was going to basically take Benghazi, and there were hundreds of thousands of people live there, and he was about to march in there with tanks and guns and airplanes and everything else and just destroy the rebel stronghold. So what we've done here is we have stopped him from doing that. Now, beyond that, the point is, what's the end game? And the end game seems to be that which we cannot speak.
Right. Because if we don't, then U.S. civilians, any type of targets overseas are fair game for terrorism.
Well, all I know is that in the talking head shows that we've seen, in the commentary that's been brought forward since the speech last night, he was starting to say the right things. He started to come out and say, look, as Commander-in-Chief, it is my responsibility to deploy American military forces as I see fit to help address clear and present dangers to our national security. There's no question that Muammar Gaddafi is, in fact, a clear and present danger to our national security and the security of our interests abroad. That being said, we cannot just sit here and have this ghost, for lack of a better term, this ghost policy of saying, well, we're just going to fly a bunch of F-16s over Libya, and we'll have a bunch of naval ships just kind of sit out there just as beat cops. And that's the message that's coming out of the White House. And it just seems that even in this instance, the Obama administration can't find a solid ground to get a message out, especially in this time when the American public is calling for it. Am I misreading this, Bob?
They're hiding behind the apron strings of an international coalition of NATO countries rather than the U.S.
We had our biggest ally in NATO, Great Britain, come out and say, look, they didn't say it officially, but folks in the cabinet office have said, hey, make no mistake about it, David Cameron wants Gaddafi out. And Gaddafi is, in fact, a legitimate target. So NATO supports the idea of getting Gaddafi out.
NATO is like everybody else in the world. Everybody is saying we're there for humanitarian reasons. The fact is that is the go-in reason, but it's not the end reason. I think the reality is that everybody is dancing around the reality that they want to get rid of Gaddafi, but they're not going to say so.
So then I ask the question, what is the end game here? What is the legitimate end game message that will address the concerns of, I mean, being former military, I want to see, you know, I come from a time, and as do we all, we come from a time when if there was military conflict, regardless of the politics inside the Beltway, we always went and backed our commander-in-chief. That backing is waning right now under Obama.
Well, he doesn't have a clear message. That's the problem. We don't exactly know what the end game is.
But I guess the question is, Bob, what would be the correct message, or is there even one out there?
Well, see, I don't think that there, if the correct message, by that we mean the real underlying message, I don't think that's ever going to be stated in any public sense, because I don't think we want to be in a situation of even with the imprimatur of the of NATO and the Arab League, et cetera, and the UN, I don't think we want to be in a situation where we can decide that we're going to go and kill a leader of a foreign country because we don't like him.
I don't think killing him. I mean, let's be real. Assassination is, you know, political assassinations are against the law as it comes to the U.S. government.
He's got to be forced to step down.
Yeah. Yes. I think saying we're going to kill him is not the right answer.
No.
But I think that a legitimate answer is, in fact, we can say we are trying to remove him from power.
Yes.
And
try him in the International Criminal Court for the human rights violations, along with the mercenary groups that he has hired.
Well, you know, let's look at you know, some of the points that he brought out. You know, he made it clear last night that, and I quote, it was not in our national interest to let that happen, referring to the mass killings in Benghazi.
No, of course not. I mean, if America's principles stand for one thing, it's that people have inalienable rights. And it's clear to me, and I think clear to most people, that there aren't very many inalienable rights being exercised by the people of Libya.
No.
And they rise up against it, and the government goes to put it down, and they're killing people in the process. And that not only does that bother America, but it bothers a lot of other people.
But I will say though, that I mean, he literally put it into perspective by saying, you know, if we had waited and watched basically a city the size of Charlotte, North Carolina, which Benghazi is, and the massacre that has happened in a city the size of Charlotte, if we had waited around for it to progressively get worse, it would have, quote, reverberated across the region and stained the conscience of the world. Is that not enough reason to state the end game at this point, or does he have a political issue back here of talking to his base, a base that clearly does not agree with what he's doing?
There was enormous criticism against the U.S. for not doing anything to intervene in Rwanda, in Srebrenica, in Darfur. And now we're trying to intervene in Libya. but the message still is not clear to the American people. What is our national security interest and what is the end game? And Obama needs to do a better job of really articulating those points.
Well, we had talked about that. We had talked about that exact point before we got on the air, Bob, about the issue of the message that Obama is trying to get across. It now becomes quote unquote selective. The selective message is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been very selective in the arenas that we've gone into. We did not go into the Sudan. We did not address the situation in Darfur. But we did, at the urging of Prime Minister Tony Blair, go into the former Yugoslavia to deal with Slobodan Milosevic and his gang of thugs. So, you know, are we in fact throwing darts at a board, or is there a method to our madness as far as where we do and we don't get involved?
Well, Justin, it is in the world that we live in the real world, there are times when America's vital interests are at stake, and you act alone or with friends, but you act and you do exactly what you intend to do as vigorously and actively as you can. This was not one of those cases. It is hard to see where Gaddafi sitting in Tripoli a month ago was a matter of deep concern and danger to the American public in any way. He's not cutting off our oil. He's not helping terrorists attack the United States. He's not doing anything to us.
You're talking about Muammar Gaddafi.
Yeah, but a month ago, and less, when things began to warm up in Libya, and he couldn't just put him down by saying, hey, cool it, guys. And Benghazi, the people started around Benghazi started moving west and started taking cities. What he did was basically decide that my being in charge of Libya is more important than if I have to kill a couple of hundred thousand people, if that's what it comes down to. And that's something that I think the whole world can get upset about. We certainly got upset about it. The UN got upset about it. The Arab League got upset about it. And they authorized a strike to an airstrike, you know, in effect, a no-fly zone to stop the movement of heavy armor and troops that were trying to kill citizens.
And at the end of the day, Gaddafi's own rhetoric is what led to this.
Yes, I mean,
saying he's going to go house to house and kill anyone.
Yeah, he said they're all rats and stinks, and he's going to go and kill them all. Yeah.
Well, I will tell you right now, to address that issue, his quote last night where he said, as president, I refuse to wait for the images of slaughter and mass graves before taking action. Some are arguing right now that he did. It took us too long for
Well,
us.
Now remind yourself, last week, I think when we were talking, we were concerned, in our little group, we were concerned that the slowness of all the parts that had to come together to get an agreement that the UN should go in hadn't yet meshed, and we were afraid that it was going to be too late, even if it was approved by all the people who had to approve it. Now, it's turned out that the no-fly has been so successful, and we have, pardon me, seen the government troops, or thugs, whatever you want to call them. Apparently, an awful lot of them are hired guns from outside.
Right.
But they have been retreating rapidly under the attacks of the no-fly zone groups, who have been attacking their supplies and their weapons and their tanks and basically forcing them to fall back from Benghazi a couple of hundred miles, and the rebels have been advancing even as we speak. They're advancing on, as we say, the hometown of Gaddafi.
Right.
Well, but the march to Tripoli has been halted.
It has indeed. I mean, right now it's at a stalemate outside of what, Sirte, is that the name of the town?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everybody stopped there. There's a lot of Gaddafi's people there, and the rebels have gotten there, and now they're just looking at each other, I guess, and probably shooting rockets back and forth.
And this goes back to whether we're going to allow ground forces to go.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Obama did make it very clear as to our role in Libya. He said that the primary role for American forces is strictly providing intelligence, logistics support, search and rescue assistance, and capabilities to jam Libyan regime communications.
Yes.
Okay, is that enough in this instance? That's the question that I gather, in my opinion, that the American public is asking, you know, right now, we can do a lot of what he just described here within a 50-mile radius of D.C. Is that going to be enough, or do we have to put pressure, on not just internally, but do we have to put pressure on other organizations? The U.N. still has not committed any troops. There's arguably a peacekeeping mission that could be affected by the U.N. in this, well within its charter. We haven't seen NATO offering any ground troop support. It just seems everybody wants to tap dance around this issue of Muammar Gaddafi remaining in power.
The great thing about the resolution is it exempts the rebels from the embargo, so they can be armed.
No.
But that going to be enough?
Is that enough?
Yeah.
Or is that enough at this stage?
Okay. Let me give you a thought. I think I saw something several days ago in the Washington Post that indicated that 10 days ago or so, the government had begun looking at assets of Libyan assets in the United States that could be impounded, so they weren't available to the government. And obviously the government means Gaddafi and his family and friends, what have you. $30 billion they discovered, and they're now frozen. Now, let me make a suggestion. If I were the Secretary of State, I might call up the foreign minister of Libya and say, if you guys need that $30 billion, you go to Zurich and live there, go to Switzerland or go someplace else, get out of town, and we'll free the $30 billion up.
Yeah, but that's
Gaddafi get off and live well.
But then you have a situation where we're paying anybody who wants to shoot a couple of citizens in their home turf and then say, hey, you know what, I've been raiding the coffers of my country for so long. Hey, you know what, I can actually get out of here and just live comfortably for the rest of my life on $30 billion if you're holding a country
hands. You think Mubarak isn't going to has a deal just like that?
No. I'm not saying.
What's being done behind the scenes. Yeah, they're making deals with these people.
Yeah,
of course.
The key is to have some sort of oil embargo where you refuse to buy Libyan oil.
But we know the Russians will never partake in that, nor will the Chinese.
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, the rebels are saying they're trying to get the Benghazi fields pumping again so they can ship oil.
Right, of course.
Because since they control that area.
Well, we've gone on now and had this discussion. We've gone through one break, so we might as well take a break right now. when we come back, we want to continue the discussion on what's going on in Libya. Also, I want to announce later on in the program, we've got a great guest that's going to be coming in at about the 5:15 mark. Chenrithi Kim, who is a world-renowned author. She wrote When Broken Glass Floats. She's a noted scholar, a noted author, critically acclaimed. She will be on the show later on, so I invite all of our listeners to stick around for that. And then we'll continue on with the general political discussions of the day. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
Thank you. da da da, wa da da da, da 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 da, da da da, wa da 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 da.
Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, the nation's premier cigar lounge and restaurant here, right across the street from the National Press Club. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio, and continuing our discussion from last segment, our last long segment, where we're continuing to look at the issue in Libya and the president's speech last night, addressing the American public on why and how and what our involvement is going to be going down the road in Libya. I want to continue on the track that we were talking before. When we look at what's happening right now in Libya, the president tap danced around the end game, and we've been kind of formulating what exactly is the right message for the end game. The end game's clear, but nobody wants to say it. It's ironic to me that we see the people that are criticizing the president for not acting quick enough are not the usual suspects that we would see in being hawkish. It's more of a democratic call that says, hey, we didn't do enough quick enough. But we've also got a stretched out, very thin military infrastructure that's fighting now a third front conflict. And yet he, in his mind, the president came out and gave a very definitive view of what our role is going to be. So in continuing with that, when we look at what's going on, one of the ironic things I see about this is, you know, when we look at Darfur, the call from Darfur, and we should have been involved in Darfur, came from the political left in Hollywood, the celebrity politicos that we see. George Clooney made a very sincere and mounted effort to try and get American involvement in Darfur. We didn't go there, but we got involved in Somalia. We go back to the question of, are we picking and choosing, and is that the right route to take? There's no real flow chart that says if this, then that, and, oh, we deploy military forces. How do we get around that, Bob? Or is there a way to get around it?
Well, first of all, you have to make a distinction. There are some problems. There are some countries. There are some leaders. There are some areas where it is in our national interest to be actively involved. That's because of either strategic reasons for working with our allies' reasons are fundamental issues that we think we have to respond to because they affect our own security, as an example. Like, somebody trying to take over the Panama Canal,
right,
something like that.
That arguably poses a clear present danger to the U.S.
There are many, many more problems in the world that don't rise to that level, but are problems that very much bother us. I mean, example, Darfur was one. I mean, you can look at half a dozen countries at least in South Sahara Africa that are failed countries with bad guys running them, stealing all the money, you know, and the people are living in poverty. The oil country, the oil that they have isn't getting through to anybody else. Mugabe in Zimbabwe is a terrible person. But we're not going in there and helping get a revolution going or supporting one down there because it isn't in our basic fundamental interest as a country, not as a matter of we don't like, you know, it's not a question of we don't like the humanity there enough. It's a question of it's something we cannot go every place and be the savior of everybody.
And the other issue is the cost. We're overextended as it is. We're going to be absorbing most of the cost of this intervention in Libya. We're not asking China, Russia, NATO, other NATO countries to expend a lot of money on this. So,
well, I would venture to say the French are spending money. Anytime you put a patrol of aircraft overhead in some place like Northern Africa, that's going to cost money.
They're spending some money, but at the end of the day, it's going to be the U.S. that's going to have to shell out a lot of this money.
I disagree. I think that, you know, we can't take away the involvement of our NATO allies.
I'm not taking away their involvement, but there's a huge monetary risk that's associated with this intervention.
They don't have an aircraft carrier there. We have more planes there than the French do. That doesn't mean the French aren't doing a great job and they're taking the lead, and that's wonderful. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of the cost is going to come to us, disproportionate to the number of countries that are part of the group.
I think that's always going to be the case, but I go back to the question of, okay, you know, what differentiates the Black Hawk Down scenario in Somalia versus not going into the Ivory Coast? What differentiates Libya from taking action in Bahrain?
This is a slippery slope that you go down when it's purely humanitarian. And it's debatable whether it advances the U.S. interest.
What advances an interest? You know, I mean, what happened in the former Yugoslav Republic was terrible, but so is what we saw in Darfur.
Look at this. You were just saying, why are we doing this one and not another one? In Libya, do we have a base? Do we have an air base? No. Do we have a naval base? No. Do we have any supply depot? No, we have nothing there. In Bahrain, the Sixth Fleet has been for a number of years headquartered there in Bahrain, right there in the Gulf, keeping an eye on Iran and among other things, and also being the force that our ships are out there in the Indian Ocean trying to get the pirates and things like that. Those are interests we have directly. Now you can say, well, look, in Bahrain, there are some people who have been killed in the demonstrations. That is true. On the other hand, it hasn't been systematic. It hasn't been part of the structure. They have, you know, they're not killing everybody they can. Number two, we have a vital interest in having a base there.
And, Bob, you just hit on a point, because the situation in Bahrain continues to get more and more violent, and it's more strategic for the U.S. to be involved over there. But it's a conflict that I think Obama just wishes would go away.
Yeah.
You don't see a lot of the press.
No.
You don't see the Obama administration really talking about what's going on in Bahrain.
And they can't, because the basic political support in the country for Obama is the left Democratic Party. Now, and they don't like military engagement, and they don't like us interfering in places, and they certainly don't like us doing something that, you know, from their standpoint, is not a vital interest to the United States.
And we have a caller on the line. For those of you who are listening who would like to join the discussion, please feel free to call in. That call-in number is 619-638-8477. Again, the call-in number is 619-638-8477. Caller in the 203 area code, you're on the air.
A lot discussing with you is much more. The guy's saying, well, hello?
I'm sorry, can you speak up?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, well, we're just listening.
Oh, okay, we'll put you back on hold. Thank you for listening. I've got to see the 203 area code pops up. I just might as well just put them down on the hold list and just let them listen in.
That's the neck of the woods where the snake is.
Close by.
It is close by.
Thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you very much for listening and supporting Backroom Politics. Back to the discussion. And again, we invite you to call in. 619-638-8477 is the number. When we look at the idea of what is strategic for, I mean, Somalia arguably had no strategic value to the United States, but humanitarian crisis of an unbelievable proportion.
During the Cold War, it was strategic for the U.S. to use the country as a buffer against a puppet regime controlled by the communists. So that would have mandated intervention in many different countries.
Well, you know, this begs the question. You know, our discussion has been formulated around how international do we go? How far out do we extend our reach of whether you want to call it policing, public safety, protectionism? How far out do we go? There's arguments right now inside the Beltway. We're starting to hear a lot more isolationists, a la Rand Paul, a la Ron Paul. The isolation of, look, you know, it doesn't affect us inside, you know, the continental United States. Alaska and Hawaii will always be protected. Leave it alone. Let the world.
And they want to cut funding to give to countries overseas.
Is isolationism something that's coming back up and resurging in today's political environment?
I would say this. Number one, there has always been an isolationist streak in this country. You know, we're over here, we got oceans on both sides of us, we got friendly country north of us, a friendly country south of us, nobody is going to whack us too much, and so leave us alone and we'll leave you alone is an attitude that throughout American history, since we have become a internationally important country, which would mean, let's say, around World War I, ever since then, there has always been a significant and even important isolationist group. I mean, Charles Lindbergh is maybe the most famous isolationist we've ever had. But the fact of the matter was, right before World War II, he was out speaking all the time, saying, you know, let Europe fight among themselves. We don't have any interest in fighting in Europe. Those people are fighting over things they're empires. We don't care about that.
But if there hadn't been the attack on Pearl Harbor, we probably would never have
If there
have
hadn't
intervened.
Been, listen, I will tell you, I know Churchill must have said thank God on his knees the day after Pearl Harbor was attacked.
But no seated president in modern day wants to be looked at as the next Neville Chamberlain.
That's true.
So there's a catch-22 that's involved in this. And just my thought is, until we recognize we have a certain standing, I know I've said this before and I continue to stress on this, we as the world's premier superpower, and that may sound egotistical, we have an inherent responsibility to protect not only what's in our vested interest, but in the vested interest of our allies. And I would venture to say that the Libyan rebels and the general public in Libya are best served by aligning themselves with, you know, we've seen it in Central America, where the Central American governments, we were talking about this before, Bob, where, you know, we saw Nicaragua, we saw Daniel Ortega. Once the Nicaraguan people and Daniel Ortega was out the first time, we saw Nicaragua starting to see, hey, there's a whole global economy we can be a part of. We've seen countries like Brazil become major economic powerhouses. I think the Libyans would say, and I'd venture to say that even a majority of the Iranian people would believe, that trade and openness with the U.S. is a positive step to development in their country. Am I wrong in that?
I mean, people forget Gaddafi is not a legitimate leader of Libya. He took power at the late 60s in a coup. And
he's been the recognized leader. He is still invited to speak as a head of state at the UN. He's a legitimate head of state in the eyes of international law.
Not anymore, which is why we have this intervention.
Then that begs the argument of even more so, we should go in there and get this rogue head of state out, call that game.
Absolutely. But the UN doesn't seem to want to go that far.
Well, it's not just the UN, it's the White House.
And the White House, absolutely.
Well, since we are there under the mandate of the UN, we can go as far as that mandate provides, and we cannot go beyond that.
I will concur with that. I will definitely concur with that. We're going to take a break. It's quarter till the hour here on the East Coast. It's quarter to the hour just about everywhere in the world. When we come back, we're going to talk about another crisis that's looming here in Washington, more domestic.
The same old crisis.
It's the same old crisis we were talking before, all the Middle East and Japanese issues. The story of the continuing resolution and the budget for fiscal year 2011, we're going to talk about the possible government shutdown, and you're going to hear something out of Bob's mouth that I don't think has ever been said before. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Shelley's Back Room in downtown Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. With me, as always, is the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie. I am your moderator, Justin Rutt. Now, there's a voice, a noted voice, that is missing as part of our discussion, the Democratic voice of Backroom Politics, the Honorable Al Swift. Congressman Al is roaming around doing Congressman Al-type stuff here inside the Beltway.
No, he's behaving like an old fart.
No. He's actually being productive. He's actually trying to be a productive member of the Congressional Alumni. Al, we miss you. If you're listening later on, we'd love to have you back next week. Can't wait to have you back next week. We now turn our attention to a domestic crisis that's looming, that being the crisis of the budget. It is on everybody's mind right now. Congress has returned from recess. They went on recess, Bob, and everybody took a big sigh of relief. Ah, I think we've got it covered. We'll finally get a budget in place. We get back to session, and everybody's now saying, we are so far apart, it's not even funny, and a government shutdown looms very, very close. Bob, I'm going to ask you point blank this question. Do you think the government is going to shut down next week?
I'll answer that later.
Wait, we have to give out the calling number. For those of you who would like to comment on Bob's tap dancing around the question, feel free to call in. The call-in number is 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477. Bob, you want to address the question another way?
Sure. First, let's review. Since September 30 of last year, the end of the fiscal year, and October 1, the beginning of 2011 fiscal year.
Correct.
We have had a series of six continuing resolutions. What a continuing resolution is, it says that for a certain number of days and weeks, without a federal budget, the government can continue spending at the rate of the previous year on the programs that existed and were being funded in the previous year at the level they were being funded at that previous year. But any new programs and any new activities or increases cannot be started until there is a budget resolution. And as I say, we've had six continuing resolutions, and we are now within 10 days of that sixth one being expired and a possible shutdown coming on. The problem that they're having right now, interestingly enough, is less the question of the money. It has become more a question of the writers, the substantive policy directions, if you will. That's what a writer is, a policy direction for the government to do so and so. Those have risen to the level of the problems that are stymieing the negotiators.
And Bob, let me just jump in here. What are some examples of the writers? I know that one writer that's come up is the funding of NPR, and there's a couple of other key ones.
There are at least three areas that are big. Number one is the funding for NPR. Number two is any money at all for Planned Parenthood. And the third one is a series of writers that were inserted in there because they are the start of recommendations, but orders to the government to begin certain processes and that will set up the structure of the health care, the Obamacare health bill.
Right.
So all of those are in play, and they have become the biggest problem. My understanding, and I'm not sure that I'm 100% right, but my understanding is that the parties have more or less agreed that someplace between $30 billion and $36 billion in cuts will be agreeable to both sides.
Okay.
If they can reach agreement on the other issues. And the other issues are on both sides of the aisle, both sides of opinions are very, very strongly held, and it is a situation where the writers are causing people on the Democratic side to say, we will never accept these, and on the Republican side, they are saying, we want these no matter what.
I can't see the Republicans, especially the Tea Party, being willing to fund NPR or give anything to Planned Parenthood.
No.
I think there's going to be a real stalemate.
Absolutely. That's exactly where we are, Ralph. It's a true stalemate, and the question becomes, can we move beyond this stalemate and get a budget? It strikes me that there is almost no chance at all to get another continuing resolution unless in the next week that there is definite movement on both sides to solve this this blockade of action with respect to these various riders on the continuing resolution, unless they are solved.
Can the Republicans muscle through something?
They can muscle it through the House, but they can't muscle it through the Senate.
And the Senate can't send
something to the House that the House will agree on.
But it strikes me that we've got a double budget crisis here. As we go into late into the third quarter of the fiscal year 2011, We're still fighting a battle on the fiscal year 2012 issue, and it seems like, I mean, just today, Speaker Boehner and Majority Leader Eric Cantor were talking about coming up with a Republican 2012 alternative budget, which is, in my view, is that not taking their eye off the current ball? I mean, we're really playing with some sharp knives in this, and we're juggling them at this point.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, there's the negotiators on with the Senate have plenty of time to negotiate, and it, you know, the fact of the matter is, the minute we get something done on the current year budget, we'll have to turn a pivot immediately and start working on the budget for October 1 of this year going forward, 2012.
But
we haven't even started yet.
Wouldn't it make sense that we have a majority, whether it's the Republican majority in the House or the Democratic majority in the Senate, wouldn't it make sense that that majority keep its eyes on the ball for the current fiscal year without avoiding a government shutdown? I mean, we haven't even gone to the conference yet, and the conference members haven't even been named.
No, we haven't even gotten agreement yet. But the fact of the matter is, we're running a two-track system right now because we're so damn late in the 2011 fiscal year.
And wasn't this Gingrich's problem back in 95?
Yeah.
So we're going down that same path.
We're going down the path that leads likely into a brick wall, which is a shutdown.
Wait, Bob. Did you just say?
I did.
That you are predicting a government shutdown in 10 days.
No, I didn't predict it. I fear it.
You fear it.
And I fear it much more than I have any of the other of the six continuing resolutions. I have always thought we would find a way to continue funding the government and continue talking. I think right now we have gotten to the point where there is a stalemate on the issues that are riders. I think the money issue has more or less been solved. If the other issues are solved, the money issue will fall in place. But the other issues are not being solved, and so I think that we're closer to a stalemate, which will lead to a shutdown, than we have been at any other time in the last 6 months when we had resolutions coming to the floor on a continuing basis, and we've always been able to get them through.
Can an Obama administration capitalize, like we've seen in the past, the bully pulpit we keep talking about? Can the Obama administration get a message together that they can capitalize on a budget shutdown, or is that not feasible, judging from the current state of messaging coming out of the White House?
Well, first of all, the White House is the bully pulpit, and when the president speaks to the country, it's a hell of a lot more effective than when leaders of the Congress speak to the country, because he's one guy, he's the leader, we voted for him. Even the leaders of the Congress are people who have been voted on by just a small group of the population, either a state for a senator or a district for the House. So it's a lot tougher. Now, if, it depends on how a stalemate, it would lead to a breakdown and a shutdown of the government. It depends on how it plays out. It's usually a lot easier for the president to say, well, I did everything I could, but I'm sorry, you know, the Social Security checks are going to be late and the disability checks are going to be late, and we can't do this, we can't do the other, we can't do any of this, there'd be no money for this program, no money for that program, et cetera, and so forth. And the Congress is an amorphous body, and so if they're to blame for it, they get it. Now,
so the Republicans fall into that trap.
They could. Now, it depends upon whether the Republicans, let us assume that we fail, not on the money issues, but we fail on some of these issues that Republicans are concerned about.
I.e. Planned Parenthood, NPR,
Obamacare. Now, if they can say, these are what we're really after, And these are the things that are most important to you, the voters, and to us. And what we're doing is stopping them because you want them stopped. We're doing what you want us to do. Now, that's the argument they'll make. I don't know if it's pretty hard for the Congress to beat the president, in a battle for the hearts and minds of the public.
Well, we're going to take a short break. It's the top of the hour. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Backroom Politics, live every Tuesday from our nation's capital. Joining me, as always, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie. I am your moderator, Justin Russell. And we're talking about the budget situation that's going on here. We are basically getting closer and closer to what is theoretically an unavoidable government shutdown. And the fact that Bob has predicted a government shutdown is just truly, truly remarkable. He's been one of the more liberal mindsets in saying we could probably get out of this situation. I think we're at a point of no return. Bob, shocking statement from you.
Well, money is an easier thing to work out than policy. And I think the policy issues are now coming to the fore. As I said, if the policy issues were solved, I think the money issue is settled.
Well, here's the question then. those of you who listen on a regular basis, and for those listening, I invite you to call in. The number is 619-638-8477. 619-638-8477. Also, a reminder that we've got noted author, noted scholar, Chanrithi Kim, who's going to be joining us. She's the author of When Broken Glass Floats, talking about her days growing up in Cambodia during the times of the Khmer Rouge. So we invite you to stay tuned and call in with your questions there. But going back to, for anybody who's listened to us for a long time, they know that this is an offshoot of a grassroots effort called the First Congress Society, which is promoting civility in politics, civility in policy debate. This now, and we talk about compromise in political endeavors, we're not seeing a lot of compromise going on right now. Is there a world where we could see some sort of compromise come up, and where would that compromise be, or are we just too far apart in this one, Bob?
Well, it's pretty hard to compromise. Take, for example, a couple of the issues. Funding for NPR, funding for Planned Parenthood. I mean, you know, how do you square those circles? You know, you either for them or you're against them.
Well, if I was a Republican, I'd say I'll be happy to.
You are a Republican.
Well, if I was what I'm trying to say, before you interrupted, if I'm a Republican in Congress, I would say I'll be happy to fund Planned Parenthood, but I'm just not funding abortion. I'll fund preventive health services for women, breast tests, cervical tests, the whole bit, but I'm not going to fund abortion.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would you do with, how would we deal with NPR? You could say we'd cut them in half or something. I mean,
right.
There are ways to do it, but my point is it's easier to resolve money differences than it is policy differences, because policies, you're either going to do them or you're not going to do them.
Right.
And I'd even fund mental health screening and tests that Planned Parenthood could offer, but I'm just not going to fund abortion.
Yeah. Well, then, look, the Republicans have tried that for years, and it's never been successful.
Well, why don't they try it now? That shows that they're trying to compromise. Let's see what the Democrats' reaction would be.
I would venture to say that in the more socially conservative Republican realm of the moral majority, I would venture to say that those who traditionally back the Tea Party members are going to be a part of that, and they just won't stand for it.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because you want to show the American people that you're willing to compromise. And Planned Parenthood, it says they offer all these different kinds of services, that abortion is only a small part of what they offer.
But,
so let's take Planned Parenthood at their word and say, we're not going to fund abortions, but we have to get this budget done. We will provide mental health and screenings for women, all types of women's services, but just not abortion.
Bob.
Well, again, I think the real problem is that there isn't the will to do that. I think that the Tea Party people feel pretty strongly, and unless you show them a compromise that they could really embrace, and they could go back home and say, "You see, we did it. We got what you guys wanted for," it's going to be very, very difficult. And it's also going to be difficult for the Democrats on the other side to move. It's going to be just as hard for the Democrats to give in. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is their view is these are good programs. We have fought for these for 20 years. We're not going to stop it. We want Obamacare. We want it to go forward. We're going to fund it. We're not going to stop. I mean, neither side is in a position where they don't have a strong, strong view. It isn't just one side with a strong view. It's both sides with a strong view.
Is the Tea Party all in on this?
Yes, I think they're pretty strongly on these issues, yes.
But, are they cashing in any political clout that they have just to make this particular point, or do they have some in reserve right now? It strikes me that the Tea Party now is pushed the Republicans all in Congress in holding firm on these three issues without offering a lot of compromise.
I think it is fair to say that the position of the more conservative Republican members is that there should be no funding for these programs. Period.
So at some point, we're going to have to take a look and say, you know, Are you willing to cash in all of your political chips and shut down the government and hope that it doesn't turn around? Anytime we've seen a government shutdown, and we've said this before on previous shows, the one who wins is the president.
Absolutely.
Congress always takes a huge hit.
It is.
We saw it in 95. We saw it back in the 80s. We're on the verge of seeing it again.
And Obama will make the point that the Tea Party is the one that's obstructionist, that is causing the shutdown.
I would venture to say, does the Tea Party have enough stroke and enough strength to maintain its political credibility on shutting down government, Bob?
Well, they're not. I can't speak for the Tea Party.
Understood.
But they feel very firmly about these issues, and so what you have to do in the House, you got to get 218 votes. And the Democrats have about 170 votes for saying they want something on these issues. There probably are a substantial number of Republican votes who would like to compromise in this area.
Right.
And then there are the more conservative members who don't want to give an inch.
Sure.
And the real pressure is going to be on the more moderate Republicans who are quite conservative, but they have probably been here a little bit longer, and they have done a lot of work, and they're willing to compromise if they can find a reasonable compromise.
But the problem is, when they do that, then they run the risk of being challenged.
Well, and the speakers, you lose that, the majority in the House loses control of the House.
Bob, I'm going to ask this question one more time. I just want to make sure we're clear. Bob, are we going to have a government shutdown?
I told you I'd give you my answer later. And now is later.
And now is later.
And my answer is this: I would say that I have always said that I thought we would find a solution as we've gone forward in the last few months with the continuing resolutions. I am not sure anymore. I no longer feel we are sure to get past it. That doesn't mean I think we're definitely going to have a shutdown. It means, for the first time, at least I believe that it is a very real possibility.
Okay.
Very real possibility.
Well, we're going to take a 2-minute break. When we come back, we're going to have noted author, noted scholar, noted academic, Chinrithi Hem, who is the author of the book When Broken Glass Floats, Growing Up Under the Khmer Rouge. We invite you to call in with any questions. Interesting discussion here with T. Hem. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. From Shelley's Back Room in downtown Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
Thank you.
This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, live on Blog Talk Radio. Joining us now is the acclaimed author of a truly, truly remarkable book, When Broken Glass Floats. She's a noted author and noted academic, Shanrithi Him, who's joining us on the line right now. T, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
T, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate you being on Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I'm happy that you're having me on your show. Thank you so much.
Not a problem. I want to make a point. T is going to be giving a presentation at the University Club here in Washington, D.C., for the Washington, D.C. Rotary. T, you want to talk about that speech for a second before we get into the other subject?
Yes, I have been invited to speak to the Rotary Club on April 6th, which is next Wednesday. It starts at, I think, 12:15 at the UNC Club, as you said. And so I will speak about, my book, When Broken Glass Floats, and about my life in America and how that, the experience during the Khmer's time in Cambodia has shaped my life in America as a child survivor, an international speaker, and a human rights activist.
Well, John, let me ask you a question. What really drove you to decide to write this book, When Broken Glass Floats?
There are many factors here. When the Khmer took over in Cambodia, I was only 9 years old. And, Cambodia was going through civil war since, I think, early 70s. And so as a child, I was listening to news with my father, especially. Like the voice, we listened to the Voice of America Khmer service, which broadcast from Washington, D.C. And so when the war was over and on April 17, 1975, to me, a 9-year-old, I thought, well, the war stopped, so no more fighting. Everything will be peaceful. But suddenly we were driven. All the people in Phnom Penh, which was the capital of Cambodia, over 2 million people were forced out of Phnom Penh now basically overnight. And after that, my father was executed, my uncle, and people were driven from our homes, and people were executed. And here I lost my father, whom I loved dearly, and I was Maddie's angel. And then here, as I was going through this Khmer Rouge regime, I see the injustices done to to innocent people. And I, as a child, asked me questions because I was taught to obey, respect adults. And here, adults listening to my parents, to me, because I was forced to work in a child labor camp. And so for me, when I saw injustices done, and I wanted to say something, but I couldn't. And so after I lost my father to execution, my mom to execution, and my younger siblings to starvation and to curable disease like fever, my older sister, especially my older sister whom I idolized, who spoke fluent French and English. And so I lost her in 1979, but I get for the trip back to 1977 when I lost my mom. I thought I would live for my parents. But when my mom died, the second parent died, I said, well, I cannot just live for my parents. I have to live for me. So I wish that someday, if I survive that regime, that someday I can do something important, to pay homage to my parents. And I want to expose these injustices, done to us. So that's one of the reasons. And I never knew that I would survive in here. When I came to the U.S. in 1981, one of the main things that I wanted to do when I came to this country was tell a story, and two was to become a medical doctor because I couldn't help my older sister who died from a fever medically, so I feel guilty. I had this survival guilt. So that's why I write the book, and it's...
it's not, you know, it's just not more. Later on, I realized I just not pay homage to my parents, but I realized that I need to, you know, to educate the world about genocide in general, you know, because of, I realized not when I came to this country, I realized that's not just what happened in Cambodia, you know, with the government killing the people, but in other countries as well.
Well,
so,
when you have an experience like that in Cambodia, I mean, can you talk a little bit about growing up? You know, was it truly as a child, especially during the time of the Khmer Rouge, which a regime which did just horrible atrocities to its citizens and to the people of Cambodia. Growing up as a child, did you recognize the fear back then, and or do you look back at it now, going, my gosh, had I known then what I know now, I would have had a whole different view.
Yes, you know, back then, I'm glad you asked that question because I didn't understand the hatred between, you know, the peasants where my family went to. We were, after we left the capital city, we went to my paternal grandparents' home in a remote area of Cambodian southern part of Cambodia, border Vietnam. So here, this is I experienced the repercussion of the U.S. Bombing of Cambodia in the late 60s to, you know, and the 70, early 70s, and that after my father was executed, I did not understand everything I suppressed because we could not talk about any, you know, we can't grieve because the informants will you know, they eavesdrop and they report and you're taken away and get killed. So here I, at 9 years old, trying to help my mom and my seven siblings survive. You know, I went to pick this it's called a type of beet. A type of vegetable, but they go like these, you know, around people's homes. So here I went and picked this vegetable and I went to this home, you know, just put in my scarf, you know, pick and put in my scarf, and I realized that these women were talking about a person, named Saint, and that he dropped bombs on them, that they're so angry, they spoke sarcastically with such hatred. They say, you know, if he comes, we don't have to kill him, we just pee on him, he'll be dead. And I realized that they were talking about my paternal uncle, who flew in the American, and he flew a reconnaissance mission for the Cambodian airport. And I was scared. I realized even at that age, I feel okay. Why would, you know, they talk about my uncle such way? Because he didn't bomb them. It was Mae Sang Kong Dae, and Mae Sang Kong Dae, you know, it means, as you probably know, it means B-52. I didn't know that until I came to the University of Oregon until I took American government in 1989. But what happened was that there's so much hatred against my uncle, my grandparents, my father, and because of the bombing, of U.S. bombing. So here, when I came to America, when I took American government back in 89, when I saw the protests, you know, the photos and the textbooks, Americans at the Kent State, I think it was Kent State and other places in America protested against the U.S. invasion in Cambodia. And so I just, like, was so touched. I cried. I broke down. And I realized, I understand the hatred against the people in the city, against my family, because they were, these peasants were indoctrinated by the Khmer Rouge, that it was the people from the city, the government then, Lungo government then, that bombed them. So the Khmer Rouge used the U.S. bombing to incite these peasants, you know, against the people from the city. So, well, you know, and...
Do you feel that, almost being a child, that the naivete almost that you were experiencing as a young child during that time, did that naive mindset possibly protect you a little bit from the true horror that was going on?
I think. But here you have a child, you know, I was a precocious child, and I I'm so fascinated. I was so fascinated with adults, you know, especially my father and how he interacted with other adults. And so, but here, when you learn all this stuff, like, you know, I listened to my father. My father spoke highly of America, you know. And to me, a child, even 4, I thought, well, America cannot do anything wrong, you know. And so when I took American government at University of Oregon back in 1989, when I found out that the U.S. bombed Cambodia, because I finally decoded the Bayside Commander to be 52, and, you know, it didn't dawn on me when I watched the movie The Killing Fields in, I think, 84. But when it dawned on me that Bayside Commander was B-52, and that was in 89, when I found out that, in my class, in my American government class, I held, you know, all the emotion in me. I took buses home, and I just threw myself, you know, on the floor, and I cried because this little girl, the 4-year-old in me, wishing that her father knew that it was America who bombed Cambodia then, and we witnessed the bombing, because I was almost 4 when we witnessed the bombing. You know, the fires burning in the distance, and it shook our home. I mean, actually, our home, we escaped our home because of the bombing. So here, this child wondered, you know, maybe it protects me, maybe not, because I asked all these questions. Why, you know, why would the other adults be listening to each other and to children?
Right.
Yeah.
I had a question.
Well, Dr. Ralph Winnie's got a question for you.
Hi, Jen Rithi.
Okay. Hi, Ralph.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank
good,
you.
Good. Can you explain why the Khmer Rouge still has support among certain sectors of the population in Cambodia, even after all these horrible atrocities have been documented?
You know, I'm not quite sure, because even some of the, I don't know, maybe it's a saving face, I'm not sure, because it's almost like, because some Cambodians, even here in the U.S., a few, international speaker because of this, my book, and one person even went ahead and said that, you know, the Khmer Rouge who could fight the Vietnamese, but all the people, all the factions will fight to fight again the Vietnamese. So that's historical problems there, and I don't know why they support, unless they I don't know, you can say delusional or whatever, but it's almost like all the people talk about, you know, that the Holocaust never happened, you know?
Right.
So,
Charithi, we've got to take a break right now. Can you stay with us for one more segment?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to put you back on hold, and we're going to take a break. For those of you listening, on the line with us is Charithi Hem, who is the author of the critically acclaimed book, When Broken Glass Floats. She's a noted author, noted speaker, noted scholar here in the United States now. She's going to stay with us for one more segment. If you'd like to call in and ask T a question, you can do so at 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Thank you.
down, 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 down.
And we're back, live from Shelley's back room. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Joining me, as always, is the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie. And for this segment, we've got a very special guest. We've got noted author, noted scholar, Chanrithi Him, who is the author of When Broken Glass Floats. She will be speaking at the University Club with the Washington Rotarians here on April 6th. Truly, truly remarkable discussion with Chanrithi. When we look back at the atrocities of the Khmer Rouge, and we see and we read about your life coming from that life to the U.S., how much does your life in Cambodia still resonate with you as far as your day-to-day being? And what, I mean, has it driven you to become the author and the academic that you are today?
Yes, definitely, most definitely. You know, I spent 16 years graduate from high school, I mean, going to high school, went to college to pursue medical school. But I realized when I filled out an application for medical school, the application it asked for to me to write, anybody to write your personal statement, why you want to become a doctor, and I broke down because I remember my older sister, Cham Chai Ya, who, you know, I mentioned, who spoke English and French very wise. And so when she died, 3 months before the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia, she died from a prolonged fever. And I remember I was so devastated that I couldn't save her. So, you know, here, and I want to become a medical doctor because I make a promise in my own way that if I survive this lifetime, you know, I want to become a doctor, but if not, I will, in the next lifetime, I want to become a medical doctor so that I can help other people because I couldn't help her. So, but when I couldn't, you know, finish that Christmas statement, I realized that, look, you have to confront what happened to you in your life during the Khmer Rouge time. So then I, you know, have already started to write essays in college, you know, when American student, you know, when we were asked to write whatever we want, I was drawn to write about that time. And at some point, I was ashamed, you know, that here, my American counterparts write about fun, you know, happy stuff, and I'm only drawn to this sad, tragic, you know, story. And so, you know, and then and the teacher said, you know, you're a natural storyteller, you know, you should be writing. I said, I just look at her, you know, I want to be a doctor, you know. And I didn't realize that, you know, when I started to speak to some high school students, and people tell me you need to write by your story, but I just kept it to myself. So, you know, and then I started to go back to medical school, but when the book was released internationally in 2000, and I have spoken at different universities in other countries and here, and I realized how much I have impacted people, empowering people, my audiences. I make them laugh, I make them cry, and I realize that maybe my calling now is, you know, become a public international speaker. And so in everything I do, I always, you know, think about what happened to me back then, you know, and in Cambodia, and in refugee camps in Thailand and the Philippines.
Now, do you still have family in Cambodia to this day?
Yes, I have aunts and uncles on my mom's side. Yes.
Have you been back to Cambodia since you left as a child? Do you routinely go back then?
No, I wish I can routinely go back, but I was honored to be invited to speak to at the University of Cambodia in Phnom Penh, which is the capital city of Cambodia, and that was in 2005, and it was the first time I went back to Cambodia in 25 years out of the country and 30 years out back to the capital city. And, you know, it was quite an excitement, but then as the day was drawn to the day I had to leave Portland, Oregon, to go to Cambodia, I was so re-traumatized because the memories came back like it comes and like flooding my mind. And I, It was one of the toughest trips that I have to do, because I went back. I have such a, what people call me, photographic memory, that it came back, that it re-traumatized me. So I spoke there, and the students, you know, were touched, and some of them, the younger generation, early 20s, they just wondered why all this happened. They asked the same question, why can't their parents talk about this? And I explained to them, you know, it also happened to my own family. They cannot, some of us who are survivors don't have the same fortitude as like me to confirm what happened and talk freely about it, because you have nightmares.
Right. Ralph has another question.
Yeah. Generous, sure. What do you feel the world should learn from what happened in Cambodia?
You know, the world, leaders, need to, think not just about their own country. They need to think about what the decision they make and affect other people, like in Cambodia. It even affect this country, because it comes back to America. I mean, because of what Nixon and Dr. Kissinger make, the Cambodian policy, it affects, Cambodia. I mean, you see the effect, the psychological effect. So they need to be mindful, because if they love their family, they need to treat other people, every policy they make. Don't just, please don't just think about themselves. Just think about other people as well. Because you can see why some people in other countries have the kind of animosity against America. And, you see that through 9/11. Whether you agree with them or not, you understand. I can't understand. Because of the way the policy was made against Cambodia, when Cambodia was not at war with America, America bombed Cambodia because of whatever, the leaders' decisions were, So I wish and pray, that people in the world will go, please go, help rebuild Cambodia, because of what happened, because the way the bombing, the U.S. bombing creates such a chaotic environment that the Khmer Rouge used that against its own people, basically it's destroying Cambodia, and Cambodia slowly recover. We need help.
Tell us a little bit about Project Empowerment.
Project Empowerment is a corporation that I registered with the state of Oregon. In what I do, whether public speaking or eventually I'm doing a business now, I would like anything I do, I want to benefit not only just about profit, it's about to benefit other people and empower people economically or whatever way. And because I was taught by my parents, my mom and my father would say, they said it to me, meaning that child, don't think just about yourself, think about other people as well. I was taught by them to think collectively, and that's what I do, I would like to empower other people.
Now, you had mentioned before the movie The Killing Fields with Dr. Hang S. Noor and Sam Waterston, truly a magnificent movie. But do you think that movie, because that's truly, when we talk about Cambodia and the killing fields, when we talk about the historical vision, that's usually where most Americans go to recall that time in Cambodia. Did that movie do a good job of portraying what it was really like during that time?
No. I admire Lord David Putnam, the producer of the movie, and the movie is powerful and compelling, and did a great job, but the story about the child informant in that movie, it was, I can say that the children's story was underreported. Because after that movie, I met with an American friend who is a child psychiatrist, and he told his friend, that I went through the same thing as the killing field. The reaction from this American friend, my friend's American friend, he said, well, she was a child, child don't suffer, children don't suffer. What he didn't know is that the informants in the movie, the killing field, they were informants, but they, you know, children suffer more because of we were innocent and we were exploited, you know, and so, but they don't understand that, he didn't understand that the informants, like the children in the movie, like one of them came to America who's my dear friend. She suffered because now she's in the mainstream different society and she realized what she did was wrong. She reported what people said and people, those people were executed. I mean,
right.
So.
Right.
So, yeah, that's why I'm hoping that someday that my story will be made to onto screen because I adapted my book into a screenplay and it's one of the finalists in a screenplay competition. And
I will tell you, John Reithy, it is truly an honor. It is truly an inspirational story that you bring to us here in Washington. I cannot tell you how much we appreciate you joining us here on Backroom Politics, and hopefully we'll have you on again. But for those of you who are listening, again, this is John Reithy Hamm. She's the author of a truly, truly a remarkable book called When Broken Glass Floats, talking about her time in Cambodia as a child during the time of the Khmer Rouge. She'll be speaking at the University Club on April 6th. To the Washington Rotarians. So if any of the Washington Rotarians here in the area are available, I strongly encourage you to go down and hear this truly, truly remarkable story. Again, Srinidhi, thank you very much for joining us today on Backroom Politics.
You're very welcome, and thank you for having me on the show.
No problem. We're going to take a short break. We're going to finish up here on Backroom Politics. We're going to go into freeform a little bit, talk about some of the other items that are out there. And, of course, the past couple of weeks we've not talked about Tell Me a Story, but we're going to bring back Tell Me a Story here in our final segment on this week's Backroom Politics. We're live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room. Stay with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes.